Mental Radio by Upton Sinclair. An adult brain audiobook production read to you by Graham Dunlop. Introduction. Mr. Upton Sinclair needs no introduction to the public as a fearless, honest, and critical student of public affairs. But in the present book, he has with characteristic courage entered a new field, one in which reputations are more easily lost than made, the field of psychic research. When he does me the honor to ask me to write a few words of introduction to this book, a refusal would imply on my part a lack of either courage or of a due sense of scientific responsibility. I have long been keenly interested in this field, and it is not necessary to hold that the researches of the past 50 years have brought any solidly established conclusions in order to feel sure that further research is very much worthwhile. Even if the results of such research should in the end prove wholly negative, that would be a result of no small importance. For, from many points of view, it is urgently to be wished that we may know where we stand in this question of the reality of alleged supernormal phenomena. In discussing this question recently with a small group of scientific men, one of them, who is perhaps the most prominent and influential of American psychologists, seemed to feel that the whole problem was settled in the negative when he asserted that at the present time no American psychologist of standing took any interest in this field. I do not know whether he meant to deny my Americanism or my standing, neither of which I can establish, but his remark, if it were true, would not in any degree support his conclusion. It would rather be a grave reproach to American psychologists. Happily, it is possible to name several young American psychologists who are keenly interested in the problem of telepathy. And it is with experiments in telepathy that Mr. Sinclair's book is chiefly concerned. In this part, as in other parts of the field of psychic research, progress must largely depend upon such work by intelligent, educated laymen or amateurs, as is here reported. For facility in obtaining seemingly supernormal phenomena seems to be of rare and sporadic occurrence, and it is the duty of men of science to give whatever encouragement and sympathetic support may be possible to all amateurs who find themselves in a position to observe and carefully and honestly to study such phenomena. Mrs. Sinclair would seem to be one of the rare persons who have telepathic power in a marked degree and perhaps other supernormal powers. The experiments in telepathy, as reported in the pages of this book, were so remarkably successful as to rank among the very best hitherto reported. The degree of success and the conditions of experiment were such that we can reject them as conclusive evidence of some mode of communication not at present explicable in accepted scientific terms, only by assuming that Mr. and Mrs. Sinclair either are grossly stupid, incompetent, and careless persons, or have deliberately entered upon a conspiracy to deceive the public in a most heartless and reprehensible fashion. I have, unfortunately, no intimate personal knowledge of Mr. and Mrs. Sinclair, but I am acquainted with some of Mr. Sinclair's earlier publications, and that acquaintance suffices to convince me, as it should convince any impartial reader, that he is an able and sincere man with a strong sense of right and wrong and of individual responsibility. His record and his writings should secure a wide and respectful hearing for what he has to tell us in the following pages. Mrs. Sinclair's account of her condition during successful experiments seems to me particularly interesting, for it falls into line with what has been observed by several other workers. Namely, they report that a peculiar passive mental state or attitude seems to be a highly favorable, if not an essential condition of telepathic communication. It would seem that if the faint and unusual telepathic processes are to manifest themselves, the track of the mind must be kept clear of other traffic. Other experiments reported in the book seem to imply some supernormal power of perception of physical things, such as is commonly called clairvoyance. It is natural and logical that alleged instances of clairvoyance should have from most of us a reception even more skeptical than we accord to telepathic claims. After all, A mind at work is an active agent of whose nature and activity our knowledge is very imperfect. And science furnishes us no good reasons for denying that its activity may affect another mind in some fashion, utterly obscure to us. But when an experimenter seems to have a large success in reading printed words shut in a thick-walled box, words whose identity is unknown to any human being, we seem to be more nearly in a position to assert positively, that cannot occur. For we do seem to know with very fair completeness the possibilities of influence extending from the printed word to the experimenter. And under the conditions, all such possibilities seem surely excluded. Yet here also we must keep the open mind, gather the facts, however unintelligible they may seem at the present, repeating observations under varied conditions. And Mrs. Sinclair's clairvoyant successes do not stand alone. They are in line with the many successful book tests recorded of recent years by competent workers of the English Society for Psychical Research, as well as with many other less carefully observed and recorded incidents. Mr. Sinclair's book will amply justify itself if it shall lead a few, let us say 2%, of his readers to undertake carefully and critically experiments similar to those which he has so vividly described. William McDougall, Duke University, NC, September 1929. Preface. I've read the book of Upton Sinclair with great interest and am convinced that the same deserves the most earnest consideration, not only of the laity, but also of the psychologists by profession. The results of the telepathic experiments carefully and plainly set forth in this book stand surely far beyond those which a nature investigator holds to be thinkable. On the other hand, it is out of the question in the case of so conscientious an observer and writer as Upton Sinclair that he is carrying on a conscious deception of the reading world. His good faith and dependability are not to be doubted. So if somehow the facts here set forth rest not upon telepathy, but upon some unconscious hypnotic influence from person to person, this also would be of high psychological interest. In no case should the psychologically interested circles pass over this book heedlessly. Signed, A. Einstein, May 23rd, 1930. Chapter 1. If you were born as long as 50 years ago, you can remember a time when the test of a sound, common sense mind was refusing to fool with newfangled notions. Without exactly putting it into a formula, people took it for granted that truth was known and familiar. And anything that was not known and familiar was nonsense. In my boyhood, the funniest joke in the world was a flying machine man. And when my mother took up a notion about germs getting into you and making you sick, my father made it a theme for no end of domestic wit. Even as late as 20 years ago, when I wanted to write a play based on the idea that men might someday be able to make a human voice audible to groups of people all over America, my friends assured me that I could not interest the public in such a fantastic notion. Among the objects of scorn in my boyhood was what we called superstition. And we made the term include not merely the notion that the number 13 brought you bad luck, but merely a belief in witches, ghosts, and goblins, but also a belief in any strange phenomena of the mind which we did not understand. We knew about hypnotism because we had seen stage performances and were in the midst of reading a naughty book called Trilby. But such things as trance mediumship, automatic writing, table tapping, telekinesis, telepathy, and clairvoyance, we didn't know these long names, but if such ideas were explained to us, we knew right away that it was all nonsense. In my youth, I had the experience of meeting a scholarly Unitarian clergyman, the Reverend Minot J. Savage of New York, who assured me quite seriously that he had seen and talked with ghosts. He didn't convince me, but he sowed the seed of curiosity in my mind, and I began reading books on psychic research. From first to last, I have read hundreds of volumes, always interested and always uncertain, an uncomfortable mental state. The evidence in support of telepathy came to seem to me conclusive, yet it never quite became real to me. The consequences of belief would be so tremendous, the changes it would make in my view of the universe so revolutionary, that I didn't believe, even when I said I did. But for 30 years, the subject has been among the things I hoped to know about, and as it happened, fate was planning to favor me. It sent me a wife who became interested and who not merely investigated telepathy but learned to practice it. For the past 3 years, I've been watching this work day by day and night by night in our home. So at last, I can say that I am no longer guessing. Now I really know. I'm going to tell you about it and hope to convince you, but regardless of what anybody can say, there will never again be a doubt about it in my mind. I know. Chapter 2. Telepathy or mind reading. That is to say, can one human mind communicate with another human mind, except by the sense channels ordinarily known and used, seeing, hearing, feeling, tasting, and touching? Can a thought or image in one mind be sent directly to another mind and there reproduced and recognized? If this can be done, how is it done? Is it some kind of vibration going out from the brain, like radio broadcasting? Or is it some contact with a deeper level of mind, as bubbles on a stream have contact with the water of the stream? And if this power exists, can it be developed and used? Is it something that manifests itself now and then like a lightning flash over which we have no control? Or can we make the energy and store it and use it regularly, as we have learned to do with the lightning which Franklin brought from the clouds? These are the questions, and the answers, as well as I can summarize them, are as follows. Telepathy is real. It does happen. Whatever may be the nature of the force, it has nothing to do with distance, for it works exactly as well over 40 miles as over 30 feet. And while it may be spontaneous and may depend on a special endowment, it can be cultivated and used deliberately, as any other object of study in physics and chemistry. The essential in this training is an art of mental concentration and auto-suggestion, which can be learned. I'm going to tell you not merely what you can do, but how you can do it, so that if you have patience and real interest, you can make your own contribution to knowledge. Starting the subject, I'm like the wandering book agent or peddler who taps on your door and gets you to open it and has to speak quickly and persuasively, putting his best goods foremost. Your prejudice is against this idea. And if you are one of my old-time readers, you are a little shocked to find me taking up a new and unexpected line of activity. You have come, after 30 years, to the position where you allow me to be one kind of crank, but you won't stand for two kinds. So let me come straight to the point. Open up my pack, pull out my choicest wares, and catch your attention with them if I can. Here is a drawing of a table fork. It was done with a lead pencil on a sheet of ruled paper, which has been photographed and then reproduced in the ordinary way. You note that it bears a signature and a date. Note from the narrator: I will not add my description of the drawings to this book. Please see the PDF attached for the details of all the figures. This drawing was produced by my brother-in-law, Robert L. Irwin, a young businessman and no kind of crank, under the following circumstances. He was sitting in a room in his home in Pasadena at a specified hour, 11:30 in the morning of July 13, 1928. Having agreed to make a drawing of any object he might select at random, and then to sit gazing at it, concentrating his entire intention upon it for a period of from 15 to 20 minutes. At the same agreed hour, 11:30 in the morning of July 13, 1928, my wife was lying on the couch in her study, in our home in Long Beach, 40 miles away by the road. She was in semi-darkness with her eyes closed, employing a system of mental concentration which she has been practicing off and on for several years, and mentally suggesting to her subconscious mind to bring her whatever was in the mind of her brother-in-law. Having become satisfied that the image which came to her mind was the correct one, because it persisted and came back again and again, she sat up and took pencil and paper and wrote the date and six words as follows. July 13th, 1928. See a table fork. Nothing else. A day or two later, we drove to Pasadena, and then in the presence of Bob and his wife, the drawing and writing were produced and compared. I have in my possession affidavits from Bob, his wife, and my wife to the effect that the drawing and writing were produced in this way. Later in this book, I shall present four other pairs of drawings made in the same way, three of them equally successful. Second case, here is a drawing, and below it, a set of five drawings. The above drawings were produced under the following circumstances. The single drawing was made by me in my study at home. I was alone, and the door was closed before the drawing was made, and was not opened until the test was concluded. Having made the drawing, I held it before me and concentrated upon it for a period of 5 or 10 minutes. The five drawings were produced by my wife, who was lying on the couch in her study some 30 feet away from me, with the door closed between us. The only words spoken were as follows. When I was ready to make my drawing, I called, "All right." And when she had completed her drawings, she called, "All right." Whereupon I opened the door and took my drawing to her and we compared them. I found that in addition to the five little pictures, she had written some explanation of how she came to draw them. This I shall quote and discuss later on. I shall also tell about six other pairs of drawings produced in this same way. Third case, another drawing produced under the following circumstances. My wife went upstairs and shut the door, which is at the top of the stairway. I went on tiptoe to a cupboard in a downstairs room and took from a shelf a red electric light bulb. It having been agreed that I should select any small article, of which there were certainly many hundreds in our home, I wrapped this bulb in several thicknesses of newspaper and put it so wrapped in a shoebox, and wrapped the shoebox in a whole newspaper and tied it tightly with a string. I then called my wife and she came downstairs and lay on her couch and put the box on her body, over the solar plexus. I sat watching and never took my eyes from her, nor did I speak a word during the test. Finally, she sat up and made her drawing with the written comment and handed it to me. Every word of the comment as well as the drawing was produced before I said a word, and the drawing and writing as here reproduced have not been touched or altered in any way. The text of my wife's written comment is as follows. First, see round glass. Guess nose glasses. No. Then comes V-shape again with a button in top. Button stands out from object. This round top is of different color from the lower part. It is light color. The other part is dark. To avoid any possible misunderstanding, perhaps I should state that the question and answer in the above were my wife's description of her own mental process and do not represent a question asked of me. She did not guess aloud, nor did either of us speak a single word during this test, except the single word "ready" to call my wife downstairs. The next drawings were produced in the following manner. The one at the top was drawn by me alone in my study, and was one of nine, all made at the same time and with no restriction upon what I should draw. Anything that came into my head. Having made the nine drawings, I wrapped each one in a separate sheet of green paper to make it absolutely invisible, and put each one in a plain envelope and sealed it, and then took the nine sealed envelopes and laid them on the table by my wife's couch. My wife then took one of them and placed it over her solar plexus and lay in her state of concentration while I sat watching her, at her insistence, in order to make the evidence more convincing. Having received what she considered a convincing telepathic message or image of the contents of the envelope, she sat up and made her sketch on a pad of paper. The essence of our procedure is this, that never did she see my drawing until hers was completed and her descriptive words written, that I spoke no word and made no comment until after this was done, and that the drawings presented here are in every case exactly what I drew, and the corresponding drawing is exactly what my wife drew, with no change or addition whatsoever. In the case of this particular pair, my wife wrote, inside of rock well with vines climbing on outside. Such was her guess as to the drawing which I had meant for a bird's nest surrounded by leaves. But you see that the two drawings are, for practical purposes, identical. Many tests have been made by each of the different methods above outlined, and the results will be given and explained in these pages. The method of attempting to reproduce little drawings was used more than any other, simply because it proved the most convenient. It could be done at a moment's notice and so fitted into our busy lives. The procedure was varied in a few details to save time and trouble, as I shall explain later. But the essential features remain unchanged. I make a set of drawings and my wife takes them one by one and attempts to reproduce them without having seen them. Here are a few samples, chosen at random because of their picturesque character. If my wife wrote anything on the drawing, I add it as a comment. And you are to understand here, and for the rest of this book, that comment means the exact words in which she wrote before she saw my drawing. Often there will be parts of this comment visible in the photograph. I give it all in print. Note that drawings 1, 2, 3, etc. are mine, while 1A, 2A, 3A, etc. are my wife's. In the case of my drawing numbered 5, my wife's comment was, "Knight's helmet." On figure 6, the comment was, "Desert scene, camel, ostrich, then below." And the drawing in figure 6A, on the reverse side of the page, is further comment, "This came in fragments, as if I saw it being drawn by invisible pencil." And here is a pair with no comment and none needed. On the following also, no comment was written. I drew figure 9 and my wife drew 9A, a striking success, and wrote the comment, "Maybe an elephant's snout, but anyway it is some kind of running animal, long thing like rope flung out in front of him." Next, a series of 3 pairs, which, as it happened, were done one after the other, numbers 3, 4, and 5 in the 23rd series of my drawings. They are selected in part because they are amusing. First, I tried to draw a bat from vague memories of my boyhood days when they used to fly into the ballrooms at Virginia Springs hotels and have to be massacred with brooms because it was believed that they sought to tangle themselves in the hair of the ladies. My wife's comment on the above reads, "Big insect. I know this is right because it moves his legs as if flying. Beetle working its legs, legs in motion." And next, my effort at a Chinese mandarin. The comment reads, "More beetles or legged bugs." And she draws the mustaches of the mandarin and his hair. Head of dragon with big mouth. See also a part of his body. In front or shoulders, the association of mandarins with dragons is obvious. And finally, my effort at a boy's foot and roller skate, which undergoes a strange telepathic transformation. I've put it upside down for easier comparison. The comment complete reads, "Profile of head and neck of animal, lion or dog, a muzzle, maybe pig snout." The above are samples of our successes. Although of such drawings, 38 were prepared by my secretary, while I made 252, a total of 290. I have classified the drawings to the best of my ability into 3 groups: successes, partial successes, and failures. The partial successes are those drawings which contain some easily recognized element of the original drawing, such as, for example, the last one above. The profile of a pig's head is not a roller skate, but when you compare the drawings, you see that in my wife's first sketch, the eyes resemble the wheels of the roller skates, and in her second sketch, the snout resembles my toe tip. Also, there is a general similarity of outline, which is what she most commonly gets. In the 290 drawings, the total of successes is 65, which is roughly 23%. The total of partial successes is 155, which is 53%. The total of failures is 70, which is 24%. I asked some mathematician friends to work out the probabilities of the above results, but I found that the problem was too complicated. Who could estimate how many possible objects there were which might come into my head to be drawn? Anytime the supply ran short, I would pick up a magazine and in the advertising pages find a score of new drawings to imitate. Again, very few of the drawings were simple. We began with such things as a circle, a square, a cross, a number, or a letter. But soon we were doing Chinese mandarins with long mustaches and puppies chasing a string. Each of these drawings has many different features. And what mathematician could count the number of these features and the chances of reproducing them? It is a matter to be judged by common sense. It seems to me anyone must agree that the chances of the 12 drawings so far shown having been reproduced by accident is too great to be worth considering. A million years would not be enough for such a set of coincidences. Chapter 3. Much of the evidence which I'm using rests upon the good faith of Mary Craig Sinclair. So before we go further, I ask your permission to introduce her. She is a daughter of the far South, her father a retired planter, bank president and judge of Mississippi. The fates endowed his oldest child with the blessings of beauty, health, wealth, and wisdom, and then spoiled it by adding a curse in the shape of a too tender heart. The griefs of other people overwhelm Craig like a suffocation. Strangers take one glance at her and instantly decide that here is one who will understand. I have seen her go into a store to buy a piece of ribbon and come out with tears in her eyes because of a tragic story which some clerk was moved to pour out to her, all in a moment, without provocation. She has always said that she gets the feelings of people, not by their words, but by intuition. But she never paid any attention to this gift, never associated it with psychic matters. She was always too busy, first with 8 younger brothers and sisters, and then with the practical affairs of an unpractical author husband. Early in childhood, things like this would happen. Her mother would say to a little Negro servant, "Go and find Miss Mary Craig." But before the boy could start, Craig would know that her mother wanted her and would be on the way. This might, of course, have been coincidence. If it stood alone, it would have no value. But the same thing happened with dreams. Craig dreamed there was a needle in her bed and woke up and looked for it in vain. In the morning, she told her mother, who slept in another room. The mother said, "How strange. I dreamed the same thing, and I woke up and really found one." Of her young ladyhood, Craig tells this story, one of many. Driving with a girlfriend miles from home, she suddenly remarked, "Let's go home. Mr. B is there." Now, this was a place to which Mr. B had never come. It was 300 miles from his town, but Craig said, "I've just had an impression of him sitting on our front porch." Going home, they found him there. Another instance of more recent date, shortly after our coming to California, my wife all at once became greatly worried about Jack London. She insisted that he was in terrible mental distress. As it happened, George Sterling had told us much about Jack's troubles. But these were of old standing, and there was nothing to account for the sudden notion which my wife took up on a certain day. We had a lot of conversation about it. I offered to take her to the London ranch, but she said she would not attempt to meddle in the affairs of a married man unless at his wife's request. I made the laughing suggestion that she go alone in the guise of a gypsy fortune teller, a role which in her young ladyhood she had played with social éclat. 2 days later, we read that Jack London was dead, and very soon came letters from George Sterling telling us that he had taken his own life. This, again, might be a coincidence. If it stood alone, I would attach no importance to it. But taken with this mass of evidence, it has a share of weight. When we were married 17 years ago, we spent some time in England, and there we met a woman physician interested in mental healing and full of ideas about psychic things. Both Craig and I were in need of healing, having been through a siege of trouble. Craig was suffering with intense headaches, something hitherto unknown in her life, while I had an ancient problem of indigestion caused by excess of brain work and lack of body work. We began to experiment with healing by the laying on of hands, without knowing anything about it, just groping in the dark. I found that I could cure Craig's headaches and get them myself, Well, she found that she could take my indigestion, a trouble she had never known hitherto. Each of us was willing to take the other's pains, but neither was willing to give them, so our experiments came to a halt. We forgot the whole subject for more than 10 years. I was busy trying to reform America, while Craig was of the most intensely materialistic convictions. Her early experiences of evangelical religion had repelled her so violently that everything suggestive of spirituality was repugnant to her. Never was a woman more practical, more centered upon the here and now, the things which can be seen and touched. I do not go into details about this, but I want to make it as emphatic as possible, for the light it throws upon her attitude and disposition. But shortly after the age of 40, her custom of carrying the troubles of all who were near her resulted in a breakdown of health, a story of suffering needless to go into. Suffice it that she had many ills to experiment upon, and mental control became suddenly a matter of life and death. In the course of the last 5 or 6 years, Craig has acquired a fair-sized library of books on the mind, both orthodox, scientific, and crank. She has sat up half the night studying marked passages and making notes, seeking to reconcile various doctrines, to know what the mind really is and how it works and what can be done with it. Always it was a practical problem. Things had to work. If now she believes anything, rest assured that it is because she has tried it out in the crucibles of pain and proved it in her daily regimen. She was not content to see psychic phenomena produced by other persons, even though authorities warned her that trances might be dangerous and that rapport with others might lead to dissociations of personality. Even so, she had to find out for herself. 100 times in the course of the experiments of which I'm going to tell, she has turned to me saying, "Can you think of any way that this can be chance? What can I do to make it more sure?" When I said the other night, "This settles it for me, I'm going to write the story," her reply was, "Wait a while." She wants to do more experimenting, but I think that enough is enough. Chapter 4. 2 years ago, Craig and I heard of a psychic, a young foreigner who was astounding physicians of Southern California, performing feats so completely beyond their understanding that they were content to watch without trying to understand. We went to see this young man and befriended him. He came to our home every day, and his strange demonstrations became familiar to us. He had the ability to produce anesthesia in many parts of his body and stick hatpins through his tongue and cheeks without pain. He could go into a deep trance in which his body became rigid and cold, and I put his head on a chair and his heels on another and stood in the middle, as if he were a 2-inch plank. We have a motion picture film showing a 150-pound rock being broken with a sledgehammer on his abdomen while he lay in this trance. The vital faculties were so far suspended in this trance that he could be shut up in an airtight coffin and buried underground for several hours. Nor was there any hocus-pocus about this. I know physicians who got the coffins and arranged for the tests and watched every detail. In Ventura, California, it was done in a ballpark, and the game was played over the grave. In our home, he gave what appeared to be a demonstration of levitation without contact. I do not say that it really was levitation. I merely say that our friends who witnessed it, physicians, scientists, writers, and their wives, 14 persons in all, were unable even to suggest a normal method by which the event could have happened. There was no one present who could have been a confederate, and the psychic had been searched for apparatus. It was in our home, where he had no opportunity whatever for preparation. His wrists and ankles were firmly held by persons whom I know well, and there was sufficient light in the room so that I could see the outline of his figure slumped in a chair. Under these circumstances, a 34-pound table rose 4 feet in the air and moved slowly at a distance of 8 feet over my head. We saw this, our friends saw it, yet in my mind, and likewise in theirs, the worm of doubt would always creep in. There are so many ways to fool people, So many conjuring tricks. Think of Houdini, for example. I was unwilling to publish what I had seen, yet also I was unwilling not to publish it. For think of the possible importance of faculties such as this, locked up in our minds. Here was my wife, ill, suffering pain, and these faculties might perhaps be used in healing. If by concentration and auto-suggestion it was possible for the mind to control the body and put a veto upon even a few of its disorders, certainly it was worthwhile for us to prove the fact. I cannot escape the moral obligation to probe these matters. This psychic claimed also to possess and demonstrate the power of telepathy or mind reading. He would go out of the room while one of us selected mentally some object in the room, not revealing the choice to anyone else. The psychic would then come back and tell us to stand behind him and concentrate our thoughts upon that object, and follow close behind him, thinking of it. He would wander about the room for a while and in the end pick up the object and do with it whatever we mentally willed him to do. We saw him make this test not less than 100 times in California, New York, and Boston. He succeeded with it more than half the time. There was no contact, no word spoken, nothing that we could imagine as giving him a clue. Did we unconsciously make in our throats some faint pronunciation of words? And did the young man have a super acuity of hearing? Again, you see, the worm of doubt, and we never could quite decide what we really believed about this performance. After puzzling over it for a year or more, my wife said, "There is only one way to be certain. I'm going to learn to do these things myself." This young man, whom I will call Jan, was a peculiar person. Sometimes he would be open and frank, and again he would be mysterious and secretive. At one time he would agree to teach us all he knew, and again he would hold on to his arts, which he had had to go all the way to India to get. Was it that he considered these forces too dangerous for amateurs to play with? Or was it merely that he was considering his means of livelihood? Jan was a hypnotist, and my wife had come to realize that all illness is more or less amenable to suggestion. She had had the idea of being hypnotized and given curative suggestions. But she did not know enough about this stranger and was unwilling to trust him. After she got to know him better, her purposes changed. Here was a fund of knowledge which she craved, and she put her woman's wits to work to get it. She told him to go ahead and hypnotize her, and explained to me her purpose of trying to turn the tables on him. Jan fixed his eyes upon hers in the hypnotic stare and made his magnetic passes. At the same time, his patient stared back, and I sat and watched a strange duel of personalities. An essential part of Jan's technique, as he explained it, was in outstaring the patient and never blinking his eyes. Now suddenly he blinked. Then he closed his eyes and kept them closed. "Do your eyes hurt?" asked his patient in pretended innocence. "No," he replied. "Are you tired?" she asked. "No, thank you," said he. "What was I thinking?" she asked. "To hypnotize me," he replied sleepily. But Craig wanted further proof, so she closed her eyes and willed that Jan should get up and go to the telephone. "Shall I go on treating you?" he asked. "Yes," said she. He hesitated a moment, then said, "Excuse me, I have to telephone to a friend." I am telling about these matters in the order of time as they came to us. I am sorry that these stories of Jan come first, because they are the strangest and the least capable of proof. In the hope of taking part of the onus from our shoulders, let me quote from a book by Charles Richet, a member of the Institute of Medicine in France, and a leading scientist. He is citing Pierre Janet, whose name is known wherever in the world the human mind is studied. The statement reads, "P. Janet, a most eminent French psychiatrist and one of the founders of the famous Salpêtrière school of psychology in Paris, and a careful and skeptical observer, has verified that a patient of his, Léonie B., being put into hypnotic sleep by himself, or his brother, from whom Leone, in her hypnotic sleep, was unable to distinguish him, could recognize exactly the substance that he placed in his mouth. Sugar, salt, pepper. One day his brother, Jay Janet, in an adjoining room, scorched his right arm above the wrist. Leone, who could have known nothing about it normally, gave signs of real pain and showed to P. Janet, who knew nothing of the occurrence, the exact place of the burn. Or let me cite the late Professor Quackenbos of Columbia University, who wrote many books on hypnotism as a therapeutic agency and tells of numerous cases of the same kind. He himself would sometimes go involuntarily into hypnotic sleep with his patient, and so sometimes would the nurse. Frequently between the hypnotist and the subject comes what is called rapport, whereby each knows what is in the other's mind, and suggestions are taken without their being spoken. You may believe this or refuse to believe it. That is your privilege. All I want to do is make clear that my wife is claiming no special achievement, but merely repeating the standard experiences of the textbooks on this subject. This rapport between Craig and her protege was developed to such an extent that she could tell him what was in his mind and what he had been doing. She told him many stories about himself, where he had been and what he had done at a certain hour. This was embarrassing to a young man who perhaps did not care to have his life so closely overseen. Also, possibly, he was wounded in his amour propre that a mere amateur, and a woman at that, should be coming into possession of his secret arts. The trick depends upon a process of intense concentration, which will later be described in detail. After this concentration, Craig would give to her subconscious mind the suggestion or command that it should bring to her consciousness a vision of what Jan was doing. This giving an order to the subconscious mind is much the same sort of that thing you do when you seek to remember a name, whether you realize it or not. You order your subconscious mind to get that bit of information and bring it to you. Whatever came to Craig, she would write it out. And when next she met Jan, she would use her woman's wits to verify it without Jan's knowing what was happening. At times, it would be very amusing when he would find himself accused of some youthful misdemeanor which his preceptress was not supposed to know about. In his efforts to defend himself, he would fail entirely to realize the telepathic aspects of the matter.
Thank you for listening to this sample. To continue listening to this book and for access to all of our other full audiobooks, please subscribe for $7.77 per month. Go to adultbrain.ca or follow the link in the show notes. This will be a completely separate podcast with a new RSS feed and will have all the titles from this feed as well. Thank you for your help and support in bringing rare and forgotten books to audio for the world.